Chapter 90. Fellow travelers, in the autumn of the year, darkness and night were creeping up to the highest ridges of the Alps. It was vintage time in the valleys on the Swiss side of the pass of the Great Saint Bernard, and along the banks of the Lake of Geneva. The air there was charged with the scent of gathered grapes. Baskets, troughs, and tubs of grapes stood in the dim village doorways, stopped the steep and narrow village streets, and had been carrying all day along the roads and lanes. Grapes, split and crushed underfoot, lay about everywhere. The child carried in a sling by the laden peasant woman toiling home was quieted with picked up grapes, the idiot sunning his big goiter under the leaves of the wooden chalet by the way to the waterfall, sat munching grapes. The breath of the cows and goats was redolent of leaves and stalks of grapes. The company in every little cabaret were eating, drinking, talking grapes. A pity that no ripe touch of this generous abundance could be given to the thin, hard, stony wine, which after all was made from the grapes. The air had been warm and transparent through the whole of the bright day. Shining metal spires and church roofs, distant and rarely seen, had sparkled in the view, and the snowy mountaintops had been so clear that unaccustomed eyes, cancelling the intervening country and slighting their rugged heights for something fabulous, would have measured them as within a few hours' easy reach. Mountain peaks of great celebrity in the valleys, whence no trace of their existence was visible sometimes for months together, had been since morning plain and near in the blue sky. And now, when it was dark below, though they seemed solemnly to recede, like specters who were going to vanish, as the red dye of the sunset faded out of them, and left them coldly white, they were yet distinctly defined in their loneliness above the mists and shadows. Seen from these solitudes, and from the pass of the Great Saint Bernard, which was one of them, the ascending night came up the mountain like a rising water. When it at last rose to the walls of the convent of the Great Saint Bernard, it was as if that weather-beaten structure were another ark, and floated on the shadowy waves. Darkness, outstripping some visitors on mules, had risen thus to the rough convent walls, when those travelers were yet climbing the mountain. As the heat of the glowing day, when they had stopped to drink at the streams of melted ice and snow, was changed to the searching cold of the frosty rarefied night air at a great height, so the fresh beauty of the lower journey had yielded to barrenness and desolation. A craggy track, up which the mules in single file scrambled and turned from block to block, as though they were ascending the broken staircase of a gigantic ruin, was their way now. No trees were to be seen, nor any vegetable growth save a poor brown scrubby moss, freezing in the chinks of rock. Blackened skeleton arms of wood by the wayside pointed upward to the convent, as if the ghosts of former travelers overwhelmed by the snow, haunted the scene of their distress. Icicle-hung caves and cellars built for refuges from sudden storms, were like so many whispers of the perils of the place. Never-resting wreaths and mazes of mist wandered about, hunted by a moaning wind, and snow, the besetting danger of the mountain, against which all its defenses were taken, drifted sharply down. The file of mules, jaded by their day's work, turned and wound slowly up the deep ascent, the foremost led by a guide on foot, in his broad-brimmed hat and round jacket, carrying a mountain staff or two upon his shoulder, with whom another guide conversed. There was no speaking among the string of riders. The sharp cold, the fatigue of the journey, and a new sensation of a catching in the breath, partly as if they had just emerged from very clear crisp water, and partly as if they had been sobbing, kept them silent. At length, a light on the summit of the rocky staircase gleamed through the snow and mist. The guides called to the mules pricked up their drooping heads, the travelers' tongues were loosened, and in a sudden burst of slipping, climbing, jingling, clinking, and talking, they arrived at the convent door. Other mules had arrived not long before, some with peasant riders and some with goods, and had trodden the snow about the door into a pool of mud. Riding saddles and bridles, pack saddles and strings of bells, mules and men, lanterns, torches, sacks, provender, barrels, cheeses, kegs of honey and butter, straw bundles and packages of many shapes, were crowded confusedly together in this thawed quagmire, and about the steps. Up here in the clouds, everything was seen through cloud, and seemed dissolving into cloud. The breath of the men was cloud, the breath of the mules was cloud, the lights were encircled by cloud, speakers close at hand, were not seen for cloud, though their voices and all other sounds were surprisingly clear. Of the cloudy line of mules hastily tied to rings in the wall, one would bite another, or kick another, and then the whole mist would be disturbed. With men diving into it, and cries of men and beasts coming out of it, and no bystander discerning what was wrong. In the midst of this, the great stable of the convent, occupying the basement story and entered by the basement door, outside which all the disorder was, poured forth its contribution of cloud, as if the whole rugged edifice were filled with nothing else, and would collapse, as soon as it had emptied itself, leaving the snow to fall upon the bare mountain summit. While all this noise and hurry were rife among the living travelers, there too, silently assembled in a grated house half a dozen paces removed, with the same cloud enfolding them, and the same snowflakes drifting in upon them, were the dead travelers found upon the mountain. The mother, storm-belated many winters ago, still standing in the corner with her baby at her breast, the man who had frozen with his arm raised to his mouth in fear or hunger, still pressing it with his dry lips after years and years. An awful company, mysteriously come together. A wild destiny for that mother to have foreseen. Surrounded by so many and such companions upon whom I never looked, and never shall look, I and my child will dwell together inseparable, on the great Saint Bernard, outlasting generations who will come to see us, and will never know our name, or one word of our story but the end. Apostrophe, the living travelers thought little, or nothing of the dead just then. They thought much more of alighting at the convent door, and warming themselves at the convent fire. Disengaged from the turmoil, which was already calming down as the crowd of mules began to be bestowed in the stable, they hurried shivering up the steps and into the building. There was a smell within, coming up from the floor, of tethered beasts, like the smell of a menagerie of wild animals. There were strong arched galleries within, huge stone piers, great staircases, and thick walls pierced with small sunken windows fortifications against the mountain storms, as if they had been human enemies. There were gloomy vaulted sleeping rooms within, intensely cold, but clean and hospitably prepared for guests. Finally, there was a parlor for guests, to sit in and sup in, where a table was already laid, and where a blazing fire shone red and high. In this room, after having had their quarters for the night allotted to them by two young fathers, the travelers presently drew round the hearth. They were in three parties, of whom the first, as the most numerous and important, was the slowest, and had been overtaken by one of the others on the way up. It consisted of an elderly lady, two gray-haired gentlemen, two young ladies, and their brother. These were attended, not to mention four guides, by a courier, two footmen, and two waiting maids. Which strong body of inconvenience was accommodated elsewhere under the same roof? The party that had overtaken them, and followed in their train, consisted of only three members, one lady and two gentlemen. The third party, which had ascended from the valley on the Italian side of the pass, and had arrived first, were four in number. A plethoric, hungry, and silent German tutor in spectacles, on a tour with three young men, his pupils, all plethoric, hungry, and silent, and all in spectacles. These three groups sat round the fire eyeing each other dryly, and waiting for supper. Only one among them, one of the gentlemen belonging to the party of three, made advances towards conversation. Throwing out his lines for the chief of the important tribe, while addressing himself to his own companions, he remarked, in a tone of voice which included all the company, if they chose to be included, that it had been a long day, and that he felt for the ladies. that he feared one of the young ladies was not a strong or accustomed traveler, and had been over-fatigued 2 or 3 hours ago, that he had observed, from his station in the rear, that she sat her mule, as if she were exhausted, that he had, twice or thrice afterwards, done himself the honor of inquiring of one of the guides, when he fell behind, how the lady did, that he had been enchanted to learn that she had recovered her spirits, and that it had been but a passing discomfort, that he trusted,
by this time he had secured the eyes of the chief, and addressed him,
he might be permitted to express his hope that she was now none the worse, and that she would not regret having made the journey. "My daughter, I am obliged to you, sir," returned the chief, "is quite restored, and has been greatly interested." New to mountains, perhaps? Said the insinuating traveler. "New to Hatu mountains," said the chief. "But you are familiar with them, sir?" The insinuating traveler assumed. "I am tolerably familiar. Not of late years. Not of late years," replied the chief, with a flourish of his hand. The insinuating traveler, acknowledging the flourish with an inclination of his head, passed from the chief to the second young lady, who had not yet been referred to otherwise than as one of the ladies in whose behalf he felt so sensitive an interest. He hoped she was not incommoded by the fatigues of the day. "Incommoded, certainly," returned the young lady, "but not tired." The insinuating traveler complimented her on the justice of the distinction. It was what he had meant to say. Every lady must doubtless be incommoded by having to do with that proverbially unaccommodating animal, the mule. "We have had, of course," said the young lady, who was rather reserved and haughty, "to leave the carriages and Fergan at Martigny, and the impossibility of bringing anything that one wants to this inaccessible place, and the necessity of leaving every comfort behind, is not convenient." "A savage place indeed," said the insinuating traveler. The elderly lady, who was a model of accurate dressing, and whose manner was perfect, considered as a piece of machinery, here interposed a remark in a low soft voice. "But, like other inconvenient places," she observed, "it must be seen. As a place much spoken of, it is necessary to see it." "I have not the least objection to seeing it, I assure you, Mrs. General," returned the other, carelessly. "You, madam," said the insinuating traveler, "have visited this spot before?" "Yes," returned Mrs. General. "I have been here before. Let me commend you, my dear," to the former young lady, "to shade your face from the hot wood, after exposure to the mountain air and snow." "You too, my dear," to the other and younger lady, who immediately did so, while the former merely said, "Thank you, Mrs. General, I am perfectly comfortable, and prefer remaining as I am." The brother, who had left his chair to open a piano that stood in the room, and who had whistled into it and shut it up again, now came strolling back to the fire with his glass in his eye. He was dressed in the very fullest and completest traveling trim. The world seemed hardly large enough to yield him an amount of travel proportionate to his equipment. "These fellows are an immense time with supper," he drawled. "I wonder what they'll give us. Has anybody any idea?" "Not roast man, I believe," replied the voice of the second gentleman of the party of three. "I suppose not. What do you mean?" he inquired. "That, as you are not to be served for the general supper, perhaps you will do us the favor of not cooking yourself at the general fire," returned the other. The young gentleman who was standing in an easy attitude on the hearth, cocking his glass at the company, with his back to the blaze, and his coat tucked under his arms, something as if he were of the poultry species, and were dressed for roasting, lost countenance at this reply. He seemed about to demand further explanation, when it was discovered through all eyes turning on the speaker, that the lady with him, who was young and beautiful, had not heard what had passed through having fainted with her head upon his shoulder. "I think," apostrophe said the gentleman in a subdued tone, "I had best carry her straight to her room. Will you call to someone to bring a light?" ? Addressing his companion, "and to show the way? In this strange rambling place I don't know that I could find it." ? "Pray, let me call my maid," ? Cried the taller of the young ladies. "Pray, let me put this water to her lips," ? Said the shorter, who had not spoken yet. Each doing what she suggested, there was no want of assistance. Indeed, when the two maids came in, escorted by the courier, lest anyone should strike them dumb, by addressing a foreign language to them on the road, there was a prospect of too much assistance. Seeing this, and saying as much in a few words to the slighter and younger of the two ladies, the gentleman put his wife's arm over his shoulder, lifted her up, and carried her away. His friend, being left alone with the other visitors, walked slowly up and down the room without coming to the fire again, pulling his black mustache in a contemplative manner, as if he felt himself committed to the late retort. While the subject of it was breathing injury in a corner, the chief loftily addressed this gentleman. "Your friend, sir," ? Said he, "is a little impatient, and, in his impatience, is not perhaps fully sensible of what he owes to hum to, but we will waive that, we will waive that. Your friend is a little impatient, sir." ? "It may be so, sir," ? Returned the other. "But having had the honor of making that gentleman's acquaintance at the hotel at Geneva, where we and much good company met some time ago, and having had the honor of exchanging company and conversation with that gentleman on several subsequent excursions, I can hear nothing, no, not even from one of your appearance and station, sir, detrimental to that gentleman." ? "You are in no danger, sir, of hearing any such thing from me. In remarking that your friend has shown impatience, I say no such thing. I make that remark because it is not to be doubted that my son, being by birth and by education a gentleman, would have readily adapted himself to any obligingly expressed wish on the subject of the fire, being equally accessible to the whole of the present circle, which, in principle, I have for all are equal on these occasions I consider right." ? "Good," ? Was the reply. "And there it ends. I am your son's Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.